guns and money.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. Alongside myself, Dan Lust, we have Mike Lawson and Terrence Sharma. Dan is still off on assignment in Siberia. Yes, he is in Siberia. Mike, Taryn, how's it going?
I'm doing well, Dan. It's good to see you again. And Mike, good to see you as well. Really interesting week in sports.
Season two. This is episode two of the year. So this is like the Derek Jeter episode, Mike. How about that? I guess before we get into the fun stuff, guys, big playoff action. I think if anybody follows me on any form of social media, this was a Buffalo Bills weekend. Nobody circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bills. So the conference finals are set on each side, the Buffalo Bills, Kansas City Chiefs. On the AFC and the NFC, we have the Packers and we have the Bucks. Guys, any thoughts about this past weekend's games that stood out?
First of all, it's good to be back. I hope you guys are doing well, staying warm. I don't know, what's Minnesota like right now? Tons of snow. I mean, we're getting some flurries around here. But I think what was interesting that we saw over this weekend was we had the games of the young and then the games of the old with the quarterback situations, right? You've got Tom Brady going against Drew Brees, who played his last game as a New Orleans Saint. If you want to talk about, you know, the GOAT of quarterbacks, you have Drew Brees, who's been in that conversation. And then you have Tom Brady proving himself in a different team, not with Coach Belichick, beating Drew Brees, and then now he's off to face probably the next GOAT in conversation in Aaron Rodgers in a very cold Green Bay game that's probably going to snow because that's just how it's going to go. So I'm excited for this upcoming weekend.
I'm excited for Josh Allen to be anointed the new prince of the NFL. I mean, we got Mahomes, okay, like nobody cares about Mahomes anymore. He sucks. Like, okay, he's done. And I'm just kidding. Mahomes is great. But I guess the question I was hoping you guys would have some thoughts on, we saw it happen twice, once in the Bills game with Lamar Jackson, and then separately we had it happen in the Chiefs game with Mahomes. We had quarterbacks knocked out of the game with concussions. And I think there wasn't the type of concussion that would really, like, you know, lay you out and you really couldn't play, but it was the type of, we'll say, this new rule after the concussion, you know, saga with Chris Nowinski, that if you have a certain level of concussion that you cannot play. I guess the way I don't know if it's necessarily a legal issue, it's kind of an ethical issue. Mahomes leaves the game and the Chiefs almost lose because of the concussion rule. They did not. Chad Henne obviously led them to a miraculous victory. But Taryn, what do you think about this concussion rule? Good, bad, need to be changed?
I think it's a good thing in theory. I'm not sure if practically it's being used all the way. In the Browns-Chiefs games, you saw that Hollywood Higgins, he got a helmet-to-helmet hit, the one that forced the fumble that went out of the back of the end zone, another questionable rule in the NFL. But I don't know if he went into the concussion protocol. And you would think that if you took a helmet-to-helmet hit at that speed, that it would cause a concussion, but it wasn't really used in that case. With Mahomes, I thought immediately that not being able to stand, I thought that they were, the spotter, whoever was doing that, was definitely going to call him out and into the tent. So I'm glad that he's okay. I saw that he passed some substantial steps this week. And I'm also looking forward to the AFC Championship. This divisional round was a little bit tough. I watched it with my girlfriend's family. They're all Ohioans, which I mentioned before. They're lifelong Cleveland Browns fans. So it was tough, but obviously everyone was happy with the way that the Browns fought.
Thoughts and prayers to Browns fans. That was a very, very close game, but they covered. So to some of us, that was enough. This that line was 10 and ended up at kickoff being 7.5. So I know a lot of people jumped on the Chiefs then. Thoughts and prayers to those guys as well, because they did not cover that. Okay.
To quote Juju, the Browns is the Browns.
The Steelers are funny because they ran their mouths a lot this past week after losing to the Browns, giving up 48 points to the Browns, and made a lot of comments about the Browns from their couch while they watched. So thoughts and prayers to them too.
Okay, team. So let us get into, this is a legal podcast after all. We do talk sports, but we'll get into the legal side of this. So today is Tuesday. It's January 19th. So couple big stories we wanted to address. We obviously were off last week. The biggest story, I think, in all of sports last week was the James Harden, we'll say the wrapping up of that saga. We talked a little bit about Harden in the past and how he was trying to force his way out. We'll go over the conspiracy theories running rampant on the internet, where that kind of falls in line in the spectrum of tampering. But yeah, James Harden is a member of the Brooklyn Nets, so we do want to get into the background of how that came to be. Number two, a story that has kind of come across my radar in the last couple of days, we'll pack into it. I'm not sure everyone has heard about it, but the University of Tennessee fired their coach, Coach Pruitt. And we'll just say there's some interesting contractual language that may lead to a mega lawsuit for wrongful termination against the school or breach of contract. So it's maybe not the sexiest story until you hear that the allegation is that Tennessee recruits were being handed bags of money in McDonald's bags. So there's a lot to unpack there. And I think third, Taryn, our resident Mets fan, he's got his Mets fan Mets hat on. The Mets GM has been fired basically, I don't know, how many, 60 days into his tenure, Taryn?
37.
All but 37 days into his tenure is fired over illicit sexual, we'll call them sexting, whatever you want to call it, eggplant emoji. Just use your imagination. So we'll get into that. There are some Mets angles to it, some legal angles to that. So that being said, let's go back to James Harden, the trade. Obviously, we gave you the history, but for those that are not following it that closely, Harden, a member of the Houston Rockets, he had made basically a demand to get out of town, and they struck a deal with the Brooklyn Nets, basically sending the entire team, really, besides Durant and Kyrie. People were sent everywhere. Caris LeVert sent over to Indiana. Jared Allen is shipped off to Cleveland. Yeah, and they basically mortgage a future for that team. So, Mike, let me start with you. First, I know you're a Sixers fan. What are your thoughts overall on the trade and kind of how this came to be?
I did not believe for one second that he was going to end up with the Sixers. I just think the deal that the Rockets probably wanted for him was it definitely would have been Ben Simmons. Maybe they brought up Joel Embiid. Definitely, they wanted too much for him. And the way that Harden was presenting himself probably didn't make it any better. I mean, Harden definitely did not want to go to the Sixers, and he probably made that clear to the Rockets, because why would he want to go? There's definitely some beef there with Morey leaving the Rockets.
Yeah, but Mike D'Antoni is sitting on the Nets bench.
True. Maybe he had a better relationship with D'Antoni. I don't know.
I don't think he had many options. Harden didn't have a no trade clause.
Yeah. I mean, it was very clear. We talked about this a couple episodes ago. I mean, it was very clear that Harden wanted to leave. He made it very clear with just his sheer insubordination of not abiding by the COVID rules and traveling and partying and going to Vegas and whatnot. Clearly letting himself go, or at least maybe the rumor of a fat suit Dan wants to talk about. But he clearly was just all signs. I mean, his points per game went down, his free throw attempts per game went down. So all of these things just showed clear signs that he was just done with the Rockets. And I think there's all this smoke. I'm going to call it smoke somehow the scheme behind closed doors of Kyrie and KD plotting this out, that Harden was going to end up with the Nets. I just think the Nets had the most draft picks and kind of rooks to send around, that it just made the most sense for the Rockets to do it. The Rockets' hand was they were literally being forced to trade Harden here. So, I don't know, Taryn, what do you think? I know you had the interesting Reddit thread that you saw. What do you think?
Yeah, I'll definitely talk about that in a second, which I'm all in on that Reddit conspiracy theory. But I think that this trade for the Nets is almost like what they thought that they were getting when they traded all those picks to Boston for Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, like well after their primes. I think Harden, obviously, really good friends with Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant really good friends with Kyrie Irving. It's well known that when they were at the All-Star game a few years ago, that Kevin Durant and Kyrie had sort of hatched this plan that they would play in New York at some point, and they both ended up with the Nets last year. And so I don't think that it's beyond possible that then when they were looking in these trade conversations to deal Harden to Brooklyn, and this is what this conspiracy theory says, is that Kyrie took this leave of absence in an effort to tank his own trade value, make it so that the Rockets wouldn't ask for Kyrie in return so that all three of them could end up playing together. And I don't know. I mean, Kyrie he said some goofy things in the past, but he's also done a lot of great work in the community. He seems to be a pretty smart guy. Durant seems to be a pretty smart guy. I wouldn't put it past them that they could have hashed up this scheme in order to get the three of them together. And so now they have it. And I don't think that this is necessarily going to be a long-term thing. They really got, I think, two bites at the apple here, right? If I'm correct about the contracts, is that they can opt out after next year. Is that right?
That's the end of next year.
Yeah. So they've really got this postseason and they've got next postseason to sort of figure it out.
Couple things. Number one, Taryn, if at any point in time that I thought the world was flat, I think you could categorically say that I was not an intelligent person. I'm just going to go out there on a limb. If you think that the world is flat, can't be that smart. I'm just going to say it for whoever's listening to this podcast. Maybe you're smart and other stuff, but I mean, that's going to bring you down in my book. So Kyrie Irving is I don't think he believes it anymore, but I think his story was that he got into a YouTube rabbit hole one day and just kind of was convinced that the world was flat and that
who amongst us has not had to deal with such a rabbit hole.
Did he think that the dinosaurs were fake too? Am I crazy? Is that also part of his thing?
I don't remember.
Wouldn't shock you if you're in the flat earth realm. Also possible dinosaurs don't exist.
But that's why this conspiracy theory says that he used that to his advantage, that everybody would expect him to just kind of take a week off and, you know, be at his sister's birthday party or show up for a DA's fundraising event.
So let's unpack it. Mike, you said my favorite two words that were trending on Twitter, fat suit. Fat suit is going to bring up Michael. You know, it's like the nutty professor. There's like a lot of good fat suit jokes in here. But the reason it comes up, and obviously, Mike, you touched on it in terms of statistics. James Harden started off the year with a complete bang. I think he had like that 35.15 assist game, you know, his first game of the year. And all of a sudden, I remember watching a game, I don't know how long ago it was at this point, but Harden was averaging like 17 points in his last four. And if you watch Rockets games, that's not really possible with the way that the offense is designed around Harden. He gets a crazy amount of shots and he goes to the line at really high frequency. So all of a sudden, Harden, you know, by outward appearances, just really stopped trying. And there's this clip that was going around the internet. Just I'll paint a picture for people. Harden's at the top of the key, really on the right side. And he's waiting for John Wall, who's on the opposite side of the key, to come off his man and take a pass from him at the outside of the key. So he's just waiting for Wall to, you know, flash that he's open. And Harden, instead of waiting, just kind of throws the ball to the opposite side of the court and just figures that John Wall will go and get it. He didn't pass to him. He just passed to him, you know, almost like threw it out of bounds. So Wall kind of shot him a look. The next day, DeMarcus Cousins said he's kind of tanking the team. So Harden, you know, I think everyone realized Harden won out of town. And then Taryn points up this conspiracy theory, which, you know, we'll get into the tampering angle next. But essentially, right at the same time that Harden stops going to the rim, stuff that he's in control of, stops playing like James Harden, is when, you know, Kyrie Irving plays this, I'm missing games for personal reasons. And then that first game that he missed, they asked Steve Nash, you know, what was going on. And he didn't know why Kyrie was missing. It came as a surprise to him. You know, Kyrie has kind of gone, I don't want to say gone AWOL, but he's done some peculiar things in his time. So it's not that off the brand for Kyrie. But missing five games in the middle of a kind of trade negotiations might have, to Mr. Conspiracy Theory on Reddit's theory, maybe we can give this guy credit, whatever this guy's username is. But at that time, you know, you're just looking at the trade, and I know I had a lot of fun with it when that trade came out. In what world does it make sense for the Nets to not deal Kyrie, right? People are saying maybe this is insurance if Kyrie doesn't come back. It's like, no, they would have traded Kyrie if they really didn't feel that way. So I think the Nets got away with one, right? If they're just trading Allen, LeVert, a couple late first-round picks. Obviously, you know, you guys brought it up last time they did this with the Celtics. It did not work out for the franchise, but I don't know. We have a three-headed monster here, and I think let's assuming we go with this conspiracy theorist, right? You know, Harden starts wearing extra heated pads during warmups to make himself give the impression that he's fatter, right? There's people joking that he's having an extra pregame meal, and the optics are that Harden's not trying, that Kyrie's gone AWOL. And it sets itself up for a three-man trade. We've talked about this on previous podcasts, but NBA rules prohibit players that are under contract with one team from, you know, being induced to leave that team by other players, executives. You can't do that. I know the reports that came out of that Kyrie and so not Kyrie, KD and Harden had been talking for months about this plan. So whether we're talking about how they were going to fit on the court or off the court, I think they've pretty much acknowledged that they were talking about this type of scenario where they were playing together. Whether or not that constitutes tampering, we'll let the NBA figure out. But guys, what do you think? I mean, are we going to see any type of punishment from this? I think I mean, I think there's enough for investigation. I mean, we'll see if they do it, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, there's definitely enough for an investigation. And Adam Silver already said the beginning of last year that he was going to crack down even harder on these tampering things. I think there's more than enough we've seen across the board. I mean, we saw with KD when KD was trying to figure out where he wanted to go when he, you know, he basically knew his time with Golden State was coming to an end. He was just shopping any options, and he was hanging out with Kyrie and LeBron. Like he was everywhere. So I mean, of course they're going to be talking about like, let's hook up, like let's form, if you want to use the term, super team to combat LeBron and Anthony Davis, and the Lakers got better too. So like, I mean, obviously Harden was like wanted out, and that's the other thing too. I mean, we talked about Daryl Morey and D'Antoni leaving and things like that. I think Harden was done with that team before all of that happened anyways. I think last year he requested a trade too. So I mean, this was coming for a long time, and I think definitely if you see on the tampering aspect, I don't think Harden, to be honest, I don't think he cared. I honestly don't think he cared. If they want to fine him for tampering or fine KD for tampering or whatever, you know, $50,000, $100,000. Now that's nothing for these guys. I mean, Silver said he wanted to crack down. So this is his chance. And this is obvious and blatant that they were trying to get Harden. If these rumors of this conspiracy are real, that KD was holding the team together while Kyrie was off gallivanting at, you know, birthday parties and taking a leave of absence just so Kyrie was off the table so then Harden could go to the Nets. I mean, there was a lot of moving parts in that situation for a lot of things to happen, but Silver will crack down. There's enough for this investigation to go through. So, but again, I don't think they care.
The benefits to the players to form these super teams is so much larger than any tampering fine that they could be hit with. And even if you hit the organization with it, like that's not going to affect Kevin Durant and Kyrie. They're probably going to be gone by the time those draft picks come up. And even if those draft picks do come up, they're going to be towards the end of the first round. It's almost meaningless to these regulations over tampering have no teeth when it comes to building the super teams.
Just quick before we transition fully, on Harden, remember he got fined $50,000 for his little deal with going to the strip clubs or whatever he was doing. Just a note, Mike hit on it. Kyrie Irving fined $50,000 for going to birthdays. Worldwide Wob had a video breakdown of figuring out that he was on, you know, that he was at this birthday without a mask. So I don't know. The two guys that have been fined for this $50,000 are now on the same team. So, you know,
wasn't Kyrie also fined? Didn't he lose like $1 million in salary just by not playing these last few games?
I think it's probably in that vicinity. I think you missed games, or you lose a salary for every game you missed because of a violation of COVID protocol. I don't think he's losing money for the personal reasons, but the personal reasons just seem to be him getting his head right. Like he's doing Zoom calls with I think it's assistant district attorneys, and I don't know. It almost feels
like the Dennis Rodman 48 hours.
It's exactly what it feels like, except it's not 48 hours. It's been like a week. And yeah, so.
To his credit, he did just buy George Floyd's family a house. That was a part of this as well. So,
see, he could, in turn, you mentioned it, and Mike, you as well. Like, Kyrie could do a lot of good for the community, but he's paid to play basketball. And he's paid, got an ungodly amount of money. I think it's in the $30 million. Like, you know, if that's your job, you can't just like not show up and just like be a philanthropist, like do something else and be a philanthropist. Stephen A. Smith, the morning of the James Harden trade, basically said Kyrie should retire. If he doesn't like basketball, he should just retire. So there's two versions of this. And Taryn, if you're a Nets fan, you want your conspiracy theory, because then everyone game the system. Kyrie actually wants to play basketball. Harden actually wants to play. He's not going to, you know, have his extra pregame meal, right? Or whatever fat jokes we want to make. But like the other version is like Kyrie's insane. Harden is like, you know, a loose cannon. He's out for himself, and Durant's still playing on his Achilles, which, you know, is not an injury that people heal well from. So keep an eye on the Nets. But to Taryn's point, we should transition to the coach in college football. So, you know, Mike, you want to give us a quick background on it?
So Jeremy Pruitt was the head coach of the University of Tennessee, the Vols. And I think he's been there for a couple of seasons now. His record's not great. Three seasons.
16 and 19.
Yeah. Tennessee, their prowess of being a football school is definitely on the decline. So basically, Jeremy Pruitt, along with a whole gambit of athletic department staff, were fired after internal investigations for a number of NCAA violations, which involve potential recruiting violations within the football program. There's a lot of rumors of money being given to players in McDonald's bags and whatnot. It's still an ongoing investigation, so we don't know exactly all of the allegations. And basically, these are level one, level two violations, really. And basically, Jeremy Pruitt as the head coach takes the brunt, even if it was. So here's the list of other terminations. Two assistant coaches, four members of the on-campus football recruiting staff, director and assistant director of football player personnel, a football analyst and quality control coach. So that's a lot of staff to be gutted from this football program that they're going to have to rehire it and whatnot. I mean, football season just ended, so they've got time to kind of have some sort of turnaround here. But what I found interesting was Chancellor Donda Plowman, in a statement today when she announced the firing of Jeremy Pruitt, announced Coach Pruitt did not adequately promote an atmosphere of compliance and or monitor the activities of the coaches and the staff who reported to him. As soon as I listened to that, I actually laughed out loud because she just took that from the NCAA handbook. That is verbatim language that the NCAA, when they give the university a level one or a level two violations or to the coach for recruiting violations. When I was with Syracuse, I did a lot of research on interps and violations for level one, level two, level three recruiting violations. That is verbatim what they say in the violation. So I just laughed. I'm like, they're firing the coach under language that the NCAA would have put in their final determination before the investigation has even been completed. We don't even know what's happening. Now, this investigation goes all the way back to November. So they've been doing it for quite a while. And my guess is we'll probably find out more in the coming like week or so if Tennessee made their decision already, because they probably have some sort of communication with the NCAA and what's happening. But in regards to what happened, I find it very interesting. And Dan, I'm going to kick it to you in a second, but I find it very interesting that they fired all of these coaches. Now, again, in situations where I've seen a number of these recruiting violations, and we don't know how many, that was what they kept saying, that they were in shock and awe of the number of violations that happened that they were made unaware of. And that might be accurate, but a lot of these level ones and level two violations for these recruiting violations, it's like $5,000 fine, $10,000 fine, postseason ban, and the coach has to go to a certain number of education things. And that's kind of the end of it. I've never heard of a coach and the whole staff essentially getting gutted. I was shocked initially because if it was recruiting violations, which we've seen before, I think it was very, very quick to kind of pull the trigger on them. And then we see now Pruitt is coming back and there is a lawsuit and he has hired an attorney for basically a number of different things, saying that Tennessee was trying to disparage and destroy his character and reputation. And his attorney actually spoke with ESPN saying that their decision to fire Pruitt is a culmination of an orchestrated effort to renege on their contract promises made to Coach Pruitt upon his hiring in 2017. I mean, Coach Pruitt just signed an extension. So
see, I think that's the key. I was waiting for you to hit that. I mean, it's not just that they hired him, you know, in 2017, right? Less than 4 months ago, they agreed to extend him. So whatever was going on, right? I mean, he had a 3-9 season, okay? Like, that's not the be-all, end-all. Like, what are they were under 500 before that? So I think that that's something occurred, right, between now and 4 months ago. And I think, Mike, if we're just kind of figuring this out, right, that obviously you don't extend the guy. The guy goes 3-9. You owe him, I think it's 21 mil. I think it's 21 million was the number that was owed, and I think the buyout, if he was fired without cause, was 60%. So it's about like $12 million the guy's owed.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. So under this contract, if he's fired without cause, then they owe him that $12 million. And he'll have a fight, but they're going to owe him that amount of money. Now, if he's fired for cause, is when they can divest him of that. And Mike, I think it's kind of telling that it's, you know, Fulmer, the, you know, he steps down, the AD and all these different assistants. So it's not one act. It seems like it's consistent with, you know, an allegation of a culture of possible wrongdoing. I know they hired an attorney to investigate, or a law firm to investigate this last year. So it's been about a year in the making. I'm not sure if it's been investigated for a year, how 4 months into it, you know, 4 months ago, they gave him a contract extension. But that said, I want to just read, this is from the Knoxville News. Pruitt's contract includes more than 30 fire for cause provisions. So if any of these provisions are triggered, Tennessee can get back this $12 million. Among them, he can be fired for cause if he engaged in conduct likely to result in NCAA finding of a level one or level two rules violation. Or, this is the interesting one, or if someone who reports to Pruitt engaged in conduct that constitutes a level one or level two violation, or is likely to result in such a violation, and the university determines Pruitt was negligent in his oversight or lacked reasonable preventative compliance measures. So I'm not sure how they threw this in the contract. It's probably, I mean, it's very favorable. Like, if someone beneath Pruitt does something that could be a level one or level two violation, they could fire Pruitt if he didn't have enough informational control or organizational control. So I don't know, if you have a rogue actor in any type of institution, usually the coach doesn't get fired. That person gets fired. You can make an example of them. And just, you know, Mike will kind of see the fallout of this, but if they're firing all these different assistants, any one of their firings could be the reason that Pruitt is no longer with the university. It doesn't mean that Pruitt necessarily did anything wrong. But here's this point. It says at the end, right, was negligent in his oversight or lacked reasonable preventative compliance measures. These aren't objective criterion, right? This is why a lawsuit is probably more likely to result in this type of instance, because it says, you know, that it results in an NCAA violation or likely to result in an NCAA investigation or lacked reasonable preventive controls. Those are all subjective terms, right? Unless a violation actually results, right? And a violation has to result. And then you have to prove, hey, he wasn't reasonably preventative in terms of his compliance measures. Like, those are not automatics, right? You could go to an arbitrator who could just rule against him. So I know people have been talking about online, you know, from the highest levels of college football, that this is a case that is probably more likely than most to see litigation, because the contract is written in such a gray way that allowed it to trigger. But usually in this kind of gray area, maybe you would have worked out a settlement ahead of time. But it looks like Tennessee is going for the jugular and trying to claw back all $12 million that was otherwise going to be coming to him. Taryn, what are your overall thoughts on what's going on?
Just a couple things. In terms of the language that Chancellor Plowman used, I'm not surprised by that at all. I think that probably the firm that they hired to conduct this investigation told her that that's the language that she should use, because they're trying to lay the groundwork to win this case very quickly and easily, and already sort of set everything against Coach Pruitt. And I think that Pruitt's lawyer, he said that this is the culmination of an orchestrated effort to renege on contractual promises. And I think that that's what we're going to see in this case, which almost certainly is going to court, right? Because there's no clause in here that mandates a mediation. So he's free to file this in open court. And you can tell that some lawyer wrote this agreement up, because it's got that great phrase that lawyers love to use, that the University of Tennessee needs to use good faith in determining that they were firing for cause. But it is up to the University of Tennessee in the contract to determine that it's for cause. So I think it's going to be tough. Now, as far as the rumors of the McDonald's bags and all of that, I know Dan Patrick said that. I would take that with a grain of salt. Dan Patrick has been wrong about a lot recently, and I don't know why that is. Maybe his sources aren't as good as they used to be, but
it's because he switched to the Peacock Network. I think that's what it is.
It's something. I don't know. So I have no doubt that there is something fishy going on. I think in nearly every
fishy,
major college.
Taryn, or filet of fishy.
Filet of fishy. Yeah, exactly. I think nearly every big time college sports program, especially in football, is doing some sort of under the table money handover. And so I don't think that is breaking news, but it's like, if it's not working and you're 16 and 19 in three seasons and they're giving you all this money to spend on recruits, I think that they're more upset about the lack of return on their investment than anything else. And so, you know, we'll see what happens. Another thing that is interesting in this, there's a great article on Sportico today by Michael McCann about the Pruitt situation, but Another thing that's interesting in here is that there's no mitigation clause. So Pruitt is under no obligation to seek work as a coach. He's under no obligation then to remove that amount from his, like what he would be owed if he wins this case with the University of Tennessee. That's something that is at issue in the Brett Bielema case, where he was going and working for the Patriots and getting paid like, I think, a couple hundred thousand dollars, as opposed to the millions of dollars that he was getting paid by the Razorback Foundation and the University of Arkansas as their head football coach. And not to dunk on the Vols now even more, because I know that they're already down, but the reason that Pruitt is even there is that their fans, led by Clay Travis of all people, really propagated a lie about Greg Schiano and his involvement at Penn State with the Jerry Sandusky thing that was never substantiated. It's mentioned one time in one trial transcript, and it's never been substantiated by any of the main actors in the case. None of the fact finders found him at fault, but they basically said that he had ignored child rape that Jerry Sandusky had done. And that wasn't true. The real reason is that they thought that they could do better than Greg Schiano. And right now, I think I might put Rutgers on a football field against Tennessee. And I think that the game might go Rutgers' way. So as Jen Bielema might say, karma?
Karma. I mean, I don't know why you have so much faith in Rutgers after they couldn't beat Michigan. I watched most of that game not so long ago. But I'll give you guys this just in my practice experience. I know we've kind of saying that this is likely to go to court. There's nothing stopping it from going to court. But, you know, we always have to keep in mind that we talked about this, on any number of levels. Suing a university could get you blacklisted from the sport. You don't want to have that on your resume. So Pruitt probably, you know, he's got 12 million reasons to sue, right? That's the old axiom. But if that's an open court, right, like that's going to be fodder for us and the sports law field in general to go to town on. This shouldn't be that big of a news, but just with the world of college football, there's not much going on. This was front page news across everyone in college football's Twitter timeline. So if I'm his attorney, obviously we talked about his statement that, you know, you could read that equally as being, hey, we can make this really messy. If we want to, we could start deposing people left and right. Or even though there's no compulsory arbitration mediation, maybe you want to get this done behind closed doors. You know, give me $5 million, give me $6 million. But it's not necessarily going to see your courtroom. I just think because of the way this contract was drafted, for better or for worse, it's a lot of shades of gray, right? It's not like he could be fired when a criminal investigation results, which is pretty black and white. We know when a criminal investigation results. We don't know like what, you know, if a NCAA sanction is likely to result, what reasonable controls are. That's all just this weird gray language. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say the contract was probably poorly drafted for everyone's sake. It's not really clear when you can fire someone and when you can't fire someone. So, you know, that's the type of case that probably doesn't see a courtroom just because there's so much uncertainty and so much money at stake. So that said, our third and final topic, Taryn, I see you're wearing your Mets hat over here. It was a nice run for the Steve Cohen era. It was nice and squeaky clean. They get Francisco Lindor, you know, like they get Carlos Carrasco. It's like, oh, the Mets are going to be great. They're in the DJ LeMahieu sweepstakes. They're in the George Springer sweepstakes. But all of a sudden, DJ signs with the Yankees. And breaking news while we're on this podcast, George Springer signs with the Toronto Blue Jays. Oh, and what do you know? The general manager is sending dick pics to reporters. So, I don't know. Taryn, you want to fill us in on your worst nightmare coming true?
It's not my worst nightmare at all. I obviously feel terrible for the woman who had to endure this sort of treatment at Jared Porter's hands. Yeah, obviously, I think it's disgusting. But I think that the Mets handled this as well as they possibly could have. It's not like this was very widely known. Apparently the Diamondbacks didn't know about it. The Cubs say that they didn't know about it. So to backtrack, in 2016, Jared Porter, who was then an assistant general manager with the Chicago Cubs or director of pro scouting or something like that, but he was high up, pretty significant executive with the Cubs organization the year that they won their first World Series in 108 years. That year in June at Yankee Stadium, he met a foreign reporter and they began texting. And I think it was pretty innocuous at first, but it was pretty clear that he was interested and sent a couple of selfies of himself, sent a picture of a bulge in his groin. And at first she was responding, I think that there was some sort of language barrier. Then she realized what was going on, that he had sent a picture of him on a bed and what that might mean. And she resolved to cut off communication. Porter proceeded to send 62 text messages that were not answered over a span of several weeks. And that culminated in more pictures of his groin and also a picture of his erect penis. So it's obviously such a terrible situation because the woman then turned down opportunities to go cover the team in Arizona because she didn't want to run into Jared Porter. She was hiding in times where they would be in the same place. And it seems like it affected her ability to do her job. Now she's left journalism. Now she is working in finance. So obviously just such a terrible situation. But the Mets did the right thing because they took a couple of hours. They talked to Jared Porter. Sandy Alderson talked to Jared Porter. And then he came to a conclusion. Steve Cohen came to a conclusion. They had a brief phone call this morning. And then 45 minutes later, Sandy Alderson had fired Jared Porter. And that was the only decision that they possibly could have made. When Porter was reached by Jeff Passan and Mina Kimes, who wrote the story for ESPN, he initially said that he had never sent photos. They confronted him with these photos and he said, they were like stock photos, like a joke, which is somehow, I think, a worse thing to have stock photos of erect penises that you send around as a joke. Seems like it wouldn't be any better. I mean, they're both terrible.
Yeah, I think so. There's two. Maybe they are crimes to some extent, but the two wrongdoings here, if we're going to categorize them. Obviously, sending the illicit pictures, and Taryn, you did a good job breaking that down. But the other one is that once you send the illicit picture, right, and there's no response, I think the reporting is that there were 62 unanswered text messages, you know, within that, and I think they culminated with this picture. So I don't know. It's at a certain point, if someone doesn't respond after like 20 texts, right? Like in this day and age, like my sister-in-law doesn't listen to the podcast, fortunately, but like, you know, there's always like a song and dance, like, should I send a follow-up text? Should I send a third text? It's like, you know, if at work, if your boss doesn't respond to an email right away, it's like, should I follow up? Should I follow up again? It's like three is a lot, right? 62 text messages in a row is like the thing of like, just complete psychopaths. So, you know, and if you just, and I sent it to friends who aren't, you know, sports nuts, but this is an interesting story. It's just like, here's a guy, and I think it's important for purpose of the story. It's not like the whole conversation was one-sided. I guess, I'm not sure what country this reporter is from, but I guess that at some point he said, send me a picture. And I guess she had, in her culture, whichever culture, we don't know what it is, but
Sandy Alderson said Korea this morning. I don't know if he intended to say it, but he said it.
Yeah, at least in the ESPN story, it wasn't. But I guess in that culture, it's common to send pictures among friends of like faces, right? Of just normal, obviously not like bulges and groins and all that stuff. But I'm not sure if she reciprocated it, but she had said, you know, something along the lines of like, can I send you a picture? And she said yes, because, you know, she was understanding of it. So there is some, we'll give Porter a little bit of benefit of the doubt for a minute, not obviously the whole thing, but, you know, there is some sort of a language barrier that she might have been sending some mixed signals at one point. Once it gets to the point of unsolicited, you know, dick pics and 62 unwanted text messages in a row, there is no argument that she, you know, is into it anymore. So here's the gripe that I have. You know, obviously Porter, what he did is kind of gross. I mean, you can make an argument. Maybe Mike wants to take this podium, but like, you know, could the Mets fired him in like 1 minute? Sure. But like they needed to talk it over and they needed to come to terms and how they were going to break the news. And obviously Steve Cohen, the GM, breaks it on Twitter, which I thought was kind of cool. You know, 9, 10 hours after. Here's my gripe in the story. ESPN, you know, it's a Disney owned company, has known about this story since, I think it was 2017. So that's right. at the time the story, originally they learn of it, I'm not sure exactly how they learned of it, they don't do anything with it. And I guess they claim, which I don't know if I buy, but they didn't want to do anything with it because the victim here was nervous about how it would affect her career if it came out. So whatever, you buy that for what it's worth. It didn't come out. Okay, now she's out of the field. Taryn, we don't know when she left the field, right?
Recently.
But when we say recently, was it before or after Porter became the GM of the Mets is what I'm getting at?
I'm not sure.
So here's my gripe, and I think this is kind of prevalent on Twitter. I mean, this is the only part. It's like ESPN, I don't want to talk ill of ESPN, but the optics are that they sat on the story, sitting and waiting. They didn't tell the Mets. They didn't tell anybody else within baseball, all their various partners, and they waited until Porter ascended to the top of the GM, right? It's not a story if random scout for the Cubs is sending dick pics to a random person. Like, nobody really gives a shit. But if it's the GM of the Mets and the Steve Cohen and the, you know, this beautiful era of the Mets and everyone's so excited, now it's a front page story. So I take kind of issue that ESPN sat on it. And, on the Mets sense, the Mets obviously, I was reading different stories say that they thought they vetted him, but they didn't. I think there was some article that they didn't, no females had, gave him a good character. He was all male, different people within baseball. Not that it necessarily would have come up, but, the Mets, who are a partner of ESPN, just like everyone else is, maybe this was important news for ESPN to share to Major League Baseball at a certain point in time. The other part that we probably just should hit on, there's someone lying in this equation. The story is that, let's assume for purposes of this that she is Korean. There was a Korean-speaking individual within the Cubs organization that I guess was allegedly acting like a liaison between this female reporter and Porter to try to make things right. And this former, I guess now former Cubs staffer who was apparently acting as a liaison, he's, claiming that even today or whenever they spoke to him for the story that he knew about this, that he knew about the incident, he was helping with the incident. But the Cubs today are saying that they've never heard about this since it was never reported to them. So I just don't really think it's possible that the one Korean guy in the organization, or however many Korean guys, but there is a Korean guy in the organization that's serving as the liaison, the translator, whatever you want to call him. And somehow that was not facilitated by the Cubs organization. So again, these are all allegations, but I just don't think it's possible that this was kept under wraps completely for 3 years. So just doesn't really make sense. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just going back to the fact that ESPN was sitting on this for a few years, like that was the part that disgusted me. And then going into Sandy Alderson saying they did as much as they possibly could to vet him. There was no information, because I think that the three teams that he mentioned was the Cubs, the Diamondbacks, the Red Sox. He said there was no information that they had that there was any red flags. And that's the issue I took with the Cubs. I'm like, there's definitely was something more going on. And that was the same thing I heard where the liaison knew about this. And there definitely had to have been more people at the Cubs organization that knew about this, and ESPN knew about it. So who else within ESPN knew, and why didn't MLB know? And that led to the kind of conversation that I think ESPN wanted to run, was like, should Major League Baseball be more involved in the vetting process of front office staffers for Major League Baseball teams? I mean, That was what I think Sandy Alderson took, and he was the one who was like, no, this is a team process. This is like,
can I ask you this, Mike, on this point, like, don't you think Jeff Passan, if he's behind the story, loses a little bit of credibility with like the Mets organization for every scoop and every source that he had the whole time, right? He knew that they had this, sexting guy that was in the front. Like, don't you think he has kind of an obligation to say something at a certain point?
Absolutely. That was what I was thinking too. I'm like, if I'm the person who's giving scoops to Jeff Passan for these breaking deals, like that right there, like gives me more pause of I'm going to give information to Jeff right. Passan because he's just going to sit on it. Like,
and it's not, it's not reciprocated back. If the Mets are giving stories for Passan, Passan's not telling them things that they need to know. Right. And I think, I don't know what other teams he was involved in, but I think Porter was the finalist in a couple of GM searches, which I guess never came out. Right. And
But what about his obligations to the source of the story, the victim of the story? Doesn't, because the reason that it came out now is not that necessarily because Porter became GM, although I think that has something to do with it. It's that she felt that he, even though he apologized, that he hadn't apologized to her standards. She didn't believe that he really felt bad about it. And it clearly affected her big time. And she didn't want this to happen to anybody else. And in addition to that, she was out of the field, so it wasn't going to affect her professionally at this
point.
So it's those things coming together.
I'm Jeff Passan, okay, Taryn, and you're Sandy Alderson. Let's do a little role playing. This is a new segment on the podcast, the role playing. Hey, Sandy, it's Jeff Passan. I have something I wanted to tell you.
Hey, Jeff.
I mean, you can ask me how my day is, anything like that.
Yeah, how's it going, Jeff?
I guess we're getting straight to the point. Okay, so Sandy, I got to tell you something.
I'm busy.
I know you're looking at Jared Porter for the GM spot. I'm just going to tell you, I can't give you any specifics, but just going to tell you there's some really inappropriate things. If they come out, they'll come at a certain point. Some inappropriate messages sending to female staffers. I can't give you anything specific. You know, I have to protect my sources, but there's a lot of red flags about this guy. Do your own research. Anyway, Jeff Passan out. Click. See, in that scenario, I don't talk about anything about the whatever teams. Like, just give the guys a heads up, which
Alderson is. If he had done it that way, that would have been very helpful to Sandy Alderson and the Mets, because it's not like Sandy had some long-standing relationship with Jared Porter. He was a hot name that had been batted around a lot in the league for these openings.
I mean, to your point, Tara, I agree with you where I was saying, like, you definitely have to respect the source of the story. And I understand reporters not wanting to release sensitive information. And there's a lot of, you know, culture around that area of the business and holding true to, you know, we have to respect the wishes of whoever gave us the information. Totally understand that. And I understand what Dan just said with, you know, kind of, you know, reciprocating, throwing the bone, like, hey, like, I know you guys are going through the vetting process. Maybe there was some sort of conversation like that in Sandy Alderson. Just, you know, they did their own vetting process. So they were like, we didn't see any issues, you know. But I think that the biggest issue is that there was something wrong with the timing of with Porter being hired by the Mets and this information coming out, whether or not it was like going to come out first and then Porter was going to get hired. I think the timing is what I take biggest issue with. And then Jessica Mendoza talking about it earlier on ESPN2 with the fact that Dan, you brought it up before, Sandy Alderson said there was not a single recommendation from a woman, and that's a reflection on the demographics of the game in the front office aspect. You know, it was huge for the game of baseball, and there's a lot of barriers being broken for females in baseball, with especially with Kim Ang being the general manager now for the Marlins. So there's definitely barriers that are yet to be broken, but that is an issue, and that was what I took out of this. Especially with a male-dominated sport of baseball, is like, does the league need to kind of step in and kind of discuss the demographics of, like, we need more female representation, female reporters, female front office? You know, just that sake alone, I think, was an issue that I took with this.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And Dan, if Jeff Passan was able to do it the way that you said, I think that that would have been really helpful, because even today, Sandy Alderson, and credit to him for being transparent and having the press conference today, that those weren't easy questions that he answered. And he said, if we had known this, we would not have hired him.
Yeah. So, I mean, listen, like, if I'm Jeff Passan, or I don't know whose story it was Mina Kimes or Jeff Passan, your partners are Major League Baseball. You obviously owe a duty to your source, but, like, you know, you're serving Major League Baseball. So to the extent you could just say, hey, by the way, Sandy, do your own vetting of him. I can't say anything further, but you got to look into the guy. There's definitely some issues. Like, I'm not a reporter, but I just, you're not breaking any sources. You're just saying that there's issues with this guy. You don't owe this guy Porter anything. Obviously you broke the story about him. So I don't know. Interesting.
Can I just say one more thing, Dan?
Sure.
As far as women being executives in a position to give the recommendations for somebody that's going after a GM job, when I was in Arizona and presumably when Jared Porter was in Arizona, at that time, there was only one woman working in baseball operations full-time, and she was really important to the administrative side of the game, and all the executives really came to rely upon her, and she lasted through multiple general managers and front office members, but I'm still not sure if, you know, they probably didn't ask her. They were probably asking, you know, like general manager Mike Hazen, or they were talking to Theo Epstein, who's now at MLB and supposedly had zero knowledge of this. So, yeah, I think that obviously there's some failures along the way. And I think that we are going to get better from this, just as a game, people that love baseball.
Well, we can hope. I'm not sure what the silver lining necessarily is. The one thing that to guess to put a pin in the story, the Mets are, they are not replacing the GM role until the following offseason. So Mets fans have no GM to yell at because there was no one in that role. Okay, guys. So,
the assistant GM is stepping up, right? Zach Scott is bumping up from GM to GM. And Sandy,
he's a nice guy.
Maybe he's just staying pat. I thought they were saying they were not going to fill the role.
So the way that they have it right now is, and they'll have to make adjustments, but I think Sandy will come in and do more baseball stuff than he was going to anyway. But Sandy was at the front end of the Lindor trade. And then John Rico is still there. John Rico was AGM under Sandy Alderson during his first stint in New York. And Zach Scott, who I really wanted to get the GM role initially, he's also there. And he built out the Red Sox analytics department. He's really well regarded and really a nice guy. So I think that the Mets are in really good hands.
I think that provides a good segue. So we'll say we're tampering with experimenting with the new segment. We'll call this one stories to watch for this week or shows or stuff that you are looking forward to watching or that you've already watched. So as we're going through the Porter saga, the general takeaway is that this guy did something back in 2016. The media found out about it in 2017, and then it's really hitting the presses in 2021. So 5 years ago, the story is being unearthed. I watched this great documentary. I know many people have watched it. The Tiger Woods documentary on HBO Max. Part one came out 2 weeks ago. Part two came out this past week. It's really kind of the rise and fall of Tiger and his relationship with his father. It's really interesting to see what happened to him. So I'd highly recommend it. It's getting very good ratings. It's not authorized by Tiger's camp, but it's very well done. Lots of footage of him. So the reason I bring this up, we know, and I remember the name, Rachel Yucatel. That was like Tiger's main mistress, and she was all over the tabloids. I posted a picture from one of the tabloids that I thought was funny. That was the headline was called Lust in the Woods. Like you lose a ball in the woods, lost ball in the woods, you've lost in the woods. So Yucatel got all the headlines, but unbeknownst to, I've never heard of this. I guess about a year and change before that story broke, before the Thanksgiving saga when Tiger got into the car accident, whatever happened, the National Enquirer had basically found that Tiger was having an affair with a local hostess at like a restaurant that was near their house that like the Woods family would go to. And he was having this affair with her. Somehow the National Enquirer like tracked them down and got footage of them, making out and doing whatever, doing things in a parking lot. And that story, it was so interesting. I'd highly recommend the whole documentary, but this was pre everything coming out. National Enquirer got him on film and they called Tiger's camp and they said, hey, they said the woman's name. I'm not going to remember. Mindy Lawton, I think was the name, but it said, what's Tiger's relationship with Mindy Lawton, and called Tiger's camp. Tiger's camp freaked out. They tried to deny it. And then they had all this footage. So Tiger did a deal with National Enquirer, which I guess had the same owners as Men's Fitness. So to squash the story, Tiger would appear on the cover of Men's Fitness. So the story was just kind of thrown underneath the water. Right? Nobody knew about it. And then, now it comes out after the other story broke out. So, it's again, documentary is fantastic. I would tell anybody to watch if you're a fan of golf, sports. It's an interesting concept, argument of race, relationships with his father. Very interesting. But the story with Porter is that basically he knew the thing was inappropriate, right? And he said, I apologize, whatever he said in text. Maybe it was insincere, maybe it wasn't. But the guy knew about it in 2017. So you can't really, blame the guy. I think the thing was never going to go away, right? So he can wish and hope and pray that it disappeared. But he was sitting on this thing for 3 years in his conscience that this thing had occurred. It wasn't swept under the rug. So, an interesting story. But again, for my thing to watch, if you have not, I did a poll on Instagram. I was kind of surprised, like 30% of respondents had watched the Tiger doc and 70% had not. And I know that 70% are huge sports fans. So I would tell everybody to get out and watch that. It's excellent. And it's excellent because my wife watched it, who hates things sports, but she loves a good documentary. So that is my recommendation for the week. Taryn, Mike,
just two things. Does the fact that Tiger didn't have final cut on that affect it the way that the news is presented, the documentary is presented, in a way that Jordan having final cut for Last Dance did not?
So it's interesting you said that. So one of my wife's friends is someone that works at ESPN, so she was telling me that it wasn't approved. So I'm like, well, it seemed like it was pretty fair, went both sides. There's a comment from Tiger's agent about the documentary where he basically goes, this is another unauthorized and salacious attempt to tell a story without painting a complete picture. So I thought the picture was pretty fair. I mean, it said the good, it said the bad. It talked about Tiger's relationship with his father. But then I'm like,
I don't know what I'm missing. An unauthorized installation attempt is not to paint a full picture. So, Taryn, to your point, then all of a sudden I'm like, well, what is the full story? So now I'm left wanting more. So if Tiger ever comes out with his own documentary, I am jumping into that because it seems like there is more to tell. So I thought it was good, though. I mean, it wasn't as good as Last Dance, but it was still very good.
And then the second thing is that your wife tolerates all this sports talk, even though she doesn't like sports.
She does not tolerate sports talk, which sports documentaries, 30 for 30s, if they're well done, I can get her to watch it. And she watches the Bills games with me because we have a lot of money on Bills futures. So, I can get her to watch a game if there's money on it. But if we lose the money, then I'm in trouble. So, you know.
She's going to become a Patriots fan.
No, she doesn't even know what the Patriots are. She knows who Brady is, though.
One thing that I wanted to talk about, keep an eye on. So with the Cleveland Indians changing their name or announcing that they're going to change their name, there's been a lot of talk that maybe that in conjunction with the team's lease at Jacobs Field running up soon, that the team might be put up for sale and move elsewhere. Nashville is a very popular location that's being batted around. I think that Dave Dombrowski was part of that group and he's not any longer. He's with the Phillies now. Justin Timberlake is part of that group. Anyway,
Timberlake?
The Justin Timberlake. Like
bye-bye-bye Justin Timberlake?
It's gonna be my that Justin Timberlake.
We are not editing that out, Mike. That's not being edited out.
I just wanted to put Cleveland sports fans at a little bit of ease. I think that this is something that's worth a longer discussion, but Ohio Revised Code Section 9.67, it's known as the Art Modell Law after Art Modell, who stole the Browns from Cleveland and moved them to Baltimore. And this law, which has never been tested and almost was going to be tested when they were threatening to move the Columbus Crew, who just won the MLS Cup last year or 2 years ago. But that law
Columbus
says
Columbus Crew that, till I die. I don't think you knew that I knew that.
Nice.
I did know that. It's my MLS team. Go ahead.
But it says that owners whose teams use tax-supported facilities and accept financial assistance from the state are prohibited from moving to another city unless they give at least 6 months' notice and give individuals who live in the area an opportunity to purchase the team. So I think that would be interesting to discuss. I think there's so many layers to that. One thing that I was really interested in and did a lot of research on in college was about these public subsidies for professional sports stadium construction. And they're typically very bad deals for the municipalities. But if you guys have any thoughts on that, and Mike, if you have anything that you're looking forward to.
Just quick on that, Taryn. I don't subscribe to the theory that the Cleveland baseball team, whatever you want to call them, is necessarily leaving. But, you know, just keep it with a grain of salt. And I will say one thing we didn't talk about on the podcast. What's the current name of the stadium right now? Is there a name is it Progressive Field? Or am I missing
something? It's Progressive Field.
So Progressive, right? We didn't. I meant to tweet about this. I messed it. But Progressive is the main sponsor for one Baker Mayfield, okay?
And at home with Baker Mayfield.
Patrick Mahomes is the big endorser for State Farm. So this past weekend, we had the State Farm versus Progressive, the Insurance Bowl. Guys, who won the Insurance Bowl? I mean, is it Baker or is it Mahomes? Because Mahomes got hurt. Who's the superior insurance company?
Who's going to have an opportunity to play this weekend?
I'm not sure if Mahomes will have an opportunity. We all know, right? Like if the concussion protocol is legit, if it's truly legit, not only did Mahomes have a plantar fasciitis, whatever he had, he half got choked out. He had whiplash. The guy was like basically in the tent twice. He's got some serious issues going on, whether it's neurological or whether it's orthopedic, whatever it is, some serious issues. But there is a 100% chance he is playing. I don't care what the protocol is for concussion protocol. He is 100% playing. As a Bills fan, jokingly, like maybe they should abide by the protocol and he shouldn't play because that would help the Bills. But like on a serious sense, like, guys, is there any issue with like, we all know he's going to play, but like medically, right? Like if we're going to say that concussion should be a black and white thing, you're out of the game if you have a concussion. The guy's clearly not healthy. So I don't know. I mean, should that protocol be black and white? Why can you not play with if you have a concussion, but you can play with like a broken foot? I mean, listen, maybe it's the Bills fan of me talking, but there should be a scenario where Mahomes doesn't is not on the field, regardless of how serious this game is.
The whole thing with Pat Mahomes, like, stumbling when he got up, I honestly think he got choked out more than a concussion. It didn't look like that.
I think it was a nerve issue.
Yeah, I don't know what the heck it was, but I think he'll be fine. So concussion protocol or not, I mean, in that sense, what is that? Do you have to sign off some waiver? Be like, if I die, like, I'm not going to – some assurance of assumption of the risk? Like,
I don't think they have those waivers.
No, I don't think they do either. Mike, what are you looking for this weekend? Watch something you watch? What do you got for us?
I think the biggest thing to watch right now is Brian Cashman is on the prowl. I mean, he was in the dark with the backdoor shenanigans that was happening with DJ LeMahieu's crew. I mean, they were off by $25 million, I think, and which I think the Yankees won in that sense, because I think he was asking for 115 mil and he ended up with 90 mil. Which for DJ LeMahieu, I mean, a 6-year contract for DJ, that's a long contract for, what was he, 32, 30, something like that?
Yeah, but he's in the best ballpark for his swing.
No, absolutely. But I'm just saying, like, the money, like, I think the Yankees got away with that deal. I mean, he is worth closer to 20 mil a year. I think 15 mil a year is pretty solid for that. And then Corey Kluber coming out of nowhere, like, with the 1-year deal right after that. I think, knowing the way that Cashman operates, he goes for one person, like last year was Garrett Cole, and then everyone else falls after that, right? So, like, he was focused on DJ LeMahieu. I wholeheartedly believe that he made, like, an offer to Kluber, and he's like, think about it. Once DJ signs, then you could sign. So that's just the way I think he operates, because all these players, like, fall into place afterwards. I think the Yankees still have some money to dance with. I think they're at, like, $174 million right now for their luxury tax, or for their salary. And I think the luxury cap is, what, 208 mil, 210 mil, something like that. So they still have some money to play with. So, I mean – Trevor Bauer is still on the prowl. So, I mean, that could be an option for them to go for. Trevor Bauer wants dumb money. He wants like 20-something, 24 mil he won't get. But bringing Cy Young a winner, he'll probably get close to 20 mil a year. So, who knows?
As a baseball fan, I mean, I didn't play fantasy baseball this past year. It's my first time in like 20 years not playing fantasy baseball. I remember DJ LeMahieu was being this, like, in Coors Field of all places, just a slappy guy. I'm looking at his baseball reference. I'm just going to read his slugging percentages in full seasons, right? 2012, starting his first somewhat full season. 410 slugging, 361, 348, 388. And he had a 495, his first his top 15 MVP, but still in Colorado. And then 49, 428. So I would say, like, you know, I think 400 is around average, right? The guy had one outlier year. He goes to the Yankees, 520 and 590. So either the park is just beautiful for him or the guy has just changed his swing. But
also the ball is juiced now. So
the ball is juiced and steroids are legal. So it's like a little bit of everything is.
I don't think he's roiding, but
it is weird that he went from 400 in Coors, which is supposed to be the most favorable hitter's park, to like 600 and basically being a top three MVP guy in Yankee Stadium. So Mike,
didn't like the thin air.
I don't know what it is, but this is not a normal progression for me. Like a slappy hitting second baseman in Coors Field, he can't hit there, and somehow he goes to the Yankee Stadium and hits. I'm just gonna say, you know what, guys, we didn't talk about. We should have been on the agenda. I guess we'll cover it in another podcast, but there is a looming allegation. One more thing to look for: the Los Angeles Angels lawsuit. We'll bring it up in another podcast. But the clubhouse guy who was involved allegedly in this Tyler Skaggs situation, essentially starting to throw a lot of players under the bus, be it Verlander, Garrett Cole, that there is a ball doctoring saga. So that's a big shoe to drop. I remember the comments from Trevor Bauer about a year ago today, and he said that the situation with pitchers is potentially much worse than was going on with the Astros. So just keep an eye, just Astros hitters and sign stealing, which allegedly did not involve pitchers. So if there's one mega thing to keep an eye on, it is that, because this guy has already been blackballed from baseball and he is coming down swinging. So stay tuned for that, Mike, and your star pitcher, Garrett Cole. So listen, just New York, like, teams are not
like
safe.
Just not safe. Jose Canseco, talking about blackball from baseball and coming out swinging.
My new Twitter follower.
Who's your new Twitter follower?
Jose Canseco.
I thought you were going to say Billy Football.
Billy Football is fighting Jose Canseco, Mike.
Yes. That's
another right. good one. Why does Jose Canseco follow you, Taryn?
It's a great question, but clearly he's a fan of the podcast, and that's why.
He doesn't follow me, Taryn, okay? So that's not it. He must be no, into your Reddit.
He's a fan of my – no, he's into my cameos. He thinks that they're really good.
You do cameos?
No, not the app, like my cameos on the podcast. You knew that.
Listen, I downloaded the Cameo app. I like looking at Jerry from Parks and Rec's cameos. Like, he is so effing good at it. And the other one is really good. He's really good at it. The other one that's good, Mankind, Mick Foley. You know, I check out my wrestling peeps. He's like the superstar of cameo. He's done more cameos than anybody. So, you know, he looks kind of gross with that big beard. But, like, you know, he's Mick Foley. So, you know, he gets a pass. Guys, anything else to add before we put this episode officially in the books?
Conor McGregor owns Fight Island this weekend.
Taryn?
$150 million is a lot of money.
I would agree. So with that being said, team, we will see you next week on another episode. As always, I'm at Sports Law Lust on social media. Mike is at Mike_son_of_law. Everyone's nodding. I got that right. And Taryn is on Twitter at TKSharmaLaw. For Dan, who will maybe at some point join us back from Siberia, we will sign off and we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.